Just for fun, could we have somebody read chapter 20, verses 1 through 6? And if someone would read 7 through 11. And verse 12 is, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Now, a couple of things we have here. There are going to be a couple of words from one of the references that I used. And we're going to go through some background, and as you notice, this time I don't have a whole bunch of questions, but they're there. We'll ask them as we get to them. But we're also going to cover something that if you've been going to the Sunday morning Bible study, that go over, because we are going to talk how these first 12 verses especially show the attributes of God and how he was in his life. And that is going to be coupled with the background in the fact that the Ten Commandments are actually a scripture code that is based on what would be considered a legal contract of the day. Because technically this is a legal contract between God and his people. So we're going to toss all this in. We are not in any particular rush. If you have questions, because some of what I have here can be confusing, and I'm also, as you very well know, I'm going to be asking you questions on each one of the different ones, because we're going to do a contrast and we're going to do a compare, but I want to see where you get your ideas, and I think you'll be surprised at how everybody together is really on the same page. So, in starting, the Ten Commandments are the second major focus of Exodus, along with the Passover account, which is contained in Exodus 12. And they are repeated with a slightly different wording in Deuteronomy 5, 6 through 21. And that is basically a retelling of the Ten Commandments, but they've done it in Deuteronomy with the rest of the laws. These commandments have served as the basis for a major portion of the laws of Exodus. They are certainly the foundation for the ethics of the Old Testament and have made a major impact on the law codes of the nations of the civilized world. And I think sometimes we forget that the laws that we have today, especially here in the United States, are literally based on the Ten Commandments, the right and the wrong, the ethics, the morality, and it is steeped very deeply in the Judeo-Christian ethic. Which comes out of both the Old and the New Testament. So that is important, as much as people don't want to admit it. Well, when I say people, outsiders. For centuries, biblical interpreters considered the divine content with Israel to be unique. No covenant similar to it was known, and although there were countless covenants mentioned in the Bible and known from the ancient world, these were covenants generally made between two individuals or nations with essentially equal status to one another. In the Bible, for example, examples of this kind of covenant are seen between Jacob and Laban in Genesis 31:44, and the statement on that is, "So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I. Let it be a witness between you and me." And basically it's saying, Laban and Jacob are saying, we will make an agreement. This will be a binding agreement with one another. It is a legal covenant. There was a similar one made between David and Jonathan in 1 Samuel 18:13. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And here is the basis. They made an agreement between the two of them because of the mutual affection for one another. And I did not go back into the backgrounds on those for these. However, in the 1970s, there was a new study that was made possible by archaeological discoveries, and it was begun by Dr. George Mendenhall, and it sheds a different light on Yahweh's covenant with Israel. And we'll talk about that for just the next few minutes. This special study is focused on the suzerainty treaties, which were common in the ancient Near East around the second millennium BC. This kind of treaty or covenant was usually made between the suzerain, the great king, the leader, and the people who served under him. And it was a legal and binding contract. However, it was between two people. One was an overlord. The other were the people that were going to be called. Well, basically, I'm going to make the rules. You're going to follow them. You're just going to agree to do that. The suzerain usually identified himself as King of Kings and Lords of Lords. And by these titles, he claimed the ultimate authority over other kings and other subjects. In the typical treaty of this nature, several features stand out, and note these as we compare them with the covenant statements in the Bible, because there are legal form in that response. And number one, the suzerainty treaty began with a statement identifying the great king. Thus says XYZ, the king of wherever. And that compares with the statement in verse 2. I am the Lord your God. It's a statement of who is the senior partner in this covenant. It's followed by a statement of events which led up to the treaty, led up and made the treaty possible. These usually emphasize the gracious acts of the suzerain for the vassals. And the king would say, hey, we're doing all these nice and wonderful things for you, and I'm doing it because I'm such a nice guy. I also have all the money, I have all the land, and I have the troops. And that is compared with, again in verse 2, compare this with who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And basically, it is a reminder from the Lord to the Jewish people where they were and what it was, what the special thing that God had done for them that was so important and helped establish him as the leader of the contract. Now, at this point, the treaty would usually set forth a prohibition against any foreign allies. Like, yes, you're my ally now, you work for me, you're subject to me, you cannot go over and get help from the next, nor can you provide help for the next kingdom. And there is actually, it is shared in verse 3, when the Lord directs that you shall have no other gods before me. And that is a provision of the treaty. I'm going to be the Lord. I'm the one that brought you out of bondage. I brought you out of Egypt. I have cared for you. You will worship no other god but me. And it is a definitive statement. Now, following the statement, there are covenant obligations for the vassal. It's a list of matters that would be done and those which were prohibited. This compares with the rest of the commandments, setting forth Israel's obligation to God. And it starts from 3 and goes all the way through the end of 17. Where was I? And after this statement concerning, there were statements concerning where the covenant document was to be kept and specifying when it would be publicly read. Now, this was very important because we have a tendency to forget things we either don't want to remember or whether it's convenient for us to forget. And the Lord, in the Ten Commandments, does put in those directions and does direct on what they're supposed to do. It's not contained in Exodus, however. If you go to Deuteronomy 31, 9 through 11, these are the instructions. So Moses wrote this law and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. Then Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the time of the year when the remission of debts at the Feast of Booths, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place he will choose, you shall read this law in front of all Israel in their hearing. And this was set up to, again, let them know, but it codified every 7 years, because every 7 years, if somebody owed you a debt, you were supposed to put that debt into remission. You would consider it any portion that had not been paid back, it was supposed to be forgiven, and that debt no longer existed. And that was both for the good of Israel and for the people that were in debt. But they also said, you notice he gave it to the priests, and he gave it and directed that the elders were to have these commandments, and that they must be read to the people when they gathered together. Now, when you consider how many people were wandering through the countryside at that time, that is still a lot of people, but it's also a requirement so everybody would have knowledge beyond what was taught in the temple, taught by the priests during the Sabbath, as well as the reminder that we owe God and we are going to continue to do these things. The typical suzerainty covenant called upon the gods of the great king and his vassals to serve as witnesses. And as would be expected, this element is lacking in the Old Testament account of the covenant of the Ten Commandments. It's worth noting that the prophets regularly called upon the hearers and the earth to serve as witnesses against Israel. Whoops. I'm saying I did not finish that sentence out. Witnesses against Israel for having broken their vows under the Ten Commandments. And then the treaties would be concluded with a list of blessings and curses that would befall the vassal, depending on whether he remained loyal to the covenant. Now, this is again in chapter 23, 20 to 33, and Deuteronomy chapter 27 all the way through verse 68 of chapter 28, which I'm not going to read here because it gets a little bit long and you get the drift. Basically, all it is saying, if you do this, you will prosper. I will take care of you. If you don't, there will be penalties. And we will see that in some of the readings as we go through them. Now, for comparison, there are two things that stand out. First of all, especially the part on the vassals. The form of God's covenant with Israel was one with which they were familiar. It was a form that Moses must have been trained on in the palace of the Pharaoh. And as a leader, as the Pharaoh's son, he would have been well trained in all the arts and all the literature, all the covenant and treaty making that was there. This would indicate that God had begun the preparation of Moses long before Moses even knew it. The use of this form serves to illustrate again how God frequently takes common things and fills them with uncommon truth. And second, the very use of this form said to Israel with an unmistakable clarity that Yahweh is the great king. He is the King of kings, he is the Lord of lords, and the form itself communicates God's claim to absolute sovereignty over his people, which is Israel. Now, again, Moses would have been familiar with this, and because the people had lived in Egypt for so long, they would be somewhat familiar with all the goings-on and the legal intricacies of a form like this, which is why the archaeology and then this other study actually looms kind of large in our learning. Now, the Ten Commandments are also called the Decalogue and are designated in the Old Testament as the Ten Words. I will keep referring to it as the Ten Words only because the reference material I use them the words, but it depends on the translation of the Bible you're using, whether they use the word term, the words word, as in these are God's words, or whether they use these are God's commandments. But they are interchangeable. The Decalogue has been most completely interpreted as the summation of the will of the Lord for the community of Israel, drawn from an established body of legal and instructional material. Yes, the form of the Ten Commandments that are used here, the agreement of the Ten Commandments and everything else, is based on a formula that had been around for a while. And at one time, as I said, before the 1970s, there was still a line of thought that said these covenants with Israel were completely unique. Now, that is partially true in the fact that most of the treaties were used between either equals like Jacob and Laam and David and Jonathan, or between a king and his subjects. But this is different in the fact that this is between the Lord God and the entire people of Israel. But it, again, like any other contract, there are promises made on both sides to what their responsibility to the other party is. And that is very, and you could say I'm in danger of falling into legalese here, but let's be honest, the Ten Commandments are a legal document and they are a requirement we are to fulfill. So no, it's not legalese. This is what we are expected to accomplish, why we are expected to accomplish, and what the Lord had in mind when he made these agreements with us. Now, if everything I've said up to this point is true, we could say that in a profound sense, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments here, are Mosaic. They come from Moses because, and I say that because, yes, Moses did receive these instructions from God for the benefit of the people. Moses first sought to order Israel's previously unordered existence, for the relationship between Israel and the Lord, as seen in this covenant, the content of the commandments was inherent from the beginning. The violation of any one of the Ten Commandments or the Ten Words was from the beginning the violation of that relationship and the covenant. We all know that the Lord does not like chaos. He wants everything on a nice even keel. He wants his people to worship, to love, and cherish him. Doesn't want the ups and downs in life. You know, we follow the Lord, he takes care of us, and we have usually a pretty stress-free life in the relationship of that. But up to that point, the following the rules for following the Lord weren't exactly written in stone. Oh, that's a bad joke. Weren't exactly codified. And I don't like using that legal arrangement, but that's what it was. This brought a brand new and clear understanding. Because remember, in captivity and up to the point of where everybody moved down into Egypt so that the Israelites could multiply and prosper, they were also required to follow the religions of other gods. And sometimes the worship of the Lord Almighty got lost in confusion. And I don't want to say in mistranslation, because the people were used. You had your overseer saying this, you had your priest saying this, but then again, the priests were also, as we'll see later with the Roman Empire, the priests were kind of fast and loose with some of the rules that they had, but there were not a lot of rules. They weren't out there. This is actually the beginning point of where we go in and God directs how certain things are done and why they're supposed to be done. Eating blood, including everything from what is murder, what is not murder, how do you deal with a recalcitrant child, which, good, the kids aren't here, could be really bad because, like, one of those rules is if the child obeys or strikes the parent, the child is gone. And that's the penalty for not showing respect, but we'll cover that a little bit under here. So here is the beginning of bringing order into chaos through this relationship, through the Ten Commandments, and this covenant between God and his people. Now, the first five parts of it, the first five words of the covenant, have to do with that which is directly related to the senior part of the covenant, namely God, and it's his identity, his nature, his name, his day, and his claim. And this is where we're going to start getting a little bit more in-depth to in depth with the Ten Commandments, and we're going to start talking a little bit more about the commandments themselves. The intensely concentrated division of the covenant must first deal with the identity of the initiator of the covenant, which is the Lord. And that is in verse 2. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, or bondage as the case may be. The definition of the person of the Lord is made in the terms of Israel's own historical experience. That in itself is a commandment. I am your God. I am the Lord your God. It demands knowledge of me. It demands that they know who the Lord is. Acknowledge me as the one without whom chaos would still embrace you, formless and void. Know me only in my identity. I'm sorry. Know me for only in my identity do you become an entity. Only in my identity can you be identified. Know me as creator, but know me also as deliverer who brought you out of the house of bondage, out of the condition of slavery. It was I who brought you from the closed to the open, from the bitter to the sweet, from the shackled to the free, from the lost to the saved. I am the Lord your God who wrought this for you. Know me, acknowledge me, remember me, and know my identity. And again, it is a call out in the wilderness for them to realize who God is, and it's a reinforcement of their beliefs. Because if you go through everything that I just there, basically he's saying me that you are my people. People will know you as Israelites. They will know you as the people who follow me. And that becomes truer and truer as they go through the wilderness. If you remember the Ten Commandments and Charlton Heston and everything else, way back as Moses, the Egyptians knew who the Israelites were, and they knew who their God was, and that's how they identified them. They followed this other God, not necessarily the Egyptian gods. Questions? Because that's number one. Okay. Now the second word that comes under this is, it is my nature to be God alone. In the notion that there are other gods, although not in itself a denial of me, I am in fact denied, since this notion denies my nature, and in this notion, therefore, I cannot be. I toss that in because I love the academic tone on that. Good. Basically, he's saying, you shall have no other gods before me. And then there is a list of things you won't do. You shall not make for your likeness. I learned to read English this week. You shall not make for yourselves an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water underneath the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the father on the children, on the third generation and fourth generation of those who hate me. We're going to start some questions, because I want you to think about that. And I said, it is God's nature to be God alone. And basically what he is telling his people, if you follow this covenant, you belong to me. I'm not going to share you with anybody else. You are mine. You are my people. You are my responsibility. And I am going to go ahead and I am going to exercise that right. Because remember, they come out of Egypt, 100 million different God's out there. He says, but I am the one God. I am your God. There is no other. There is also the implied meaning in there that I created the heaven, the earth. I created everything that is around you. And as such, you owe me your fealty. You would not be here without me. And in that case, you are not to make... And we'll go back here again. Make for yourselves an idol in any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath the sea or in the water under the earth. Now, y'all tell me what that means. It's kind of lost in here, but you will hear it, you know. Heavens and earth, the only one you're going to honor is God himself, not the angels. You are not going to do the fertility sacrifices. You're not going to pray to that cow, the golden cow. You are not going to do anything. You're not going to make an idol of anything that I have created. I made that. No one else did. And it's a reminder along those lines, and that's very, very important, because we do that a bit. We put so many things, forgetting that everything that we have, God made for us. Everything we own, he gave us. And the comment was made again, was, you know, God, the Lord giveth, the Lord will taketh away. And that's going to be in here too. But we have those. You will not worship them or serve them. Again, that's putting something between us and the Lord. For I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those that hate me, but showing steadfast love, in this case devotion, beyond the obligation of the relationship such as it is, to the thousands of people who love me and keep my commandments. Now, we go on down here to the reading on page 7. It's the Lord's nature to be one and one alone. And y'all are smart enough to realize that the Lord is also the Trinity, but we're not going into that part now because there was only a duality at best with the Holy Spirit that was known to the Jewish people, was the Holy Spirit and Yahweh the Father. And this nature of oneness aloneness is such that it cannot be by very nature representative. We cannot make a picture of God. We cannot make a picture of his grandness, of who he is. And since it cannot in its very nature be represented, any representation of it in any form is necessarily deceiving, untrue, and therefore prohibited. And just for fun, I'm going to toss this one in. If it's saying that any representation of God, does that mean that the entire Renaissance period and all those beautiful paintings and everything else of, you know, Jesus and God's hands touching and all that other stuff is sinful? Because we don't know God and we have no real idea what God truly looks like. That's not permitted. We have an idea of what Jesus looks like, but it ain't that blonde hair, blue-eyed guy that shows up in all our Bibles and stuff. So, and I think that's where that's one of the places that Islam gets it so wrong, that just because I draw a picture of what I feel God is does not make it a sin, as long as I don't worship that picture, or as long as that's not where my obedience goes, as long as it remains with God. How we see the Lord within ourselves is perfectly all right. And that's actually a very, very good, because now the cross that Protestants wear, you notice, does not have Jesus on the cross. But that's also a theological. The Catholic Church has a tendency to look at the suffering Christ, where the Protestant Church identifies with the risen Christ. That's why when the Passion of the Christ was made, you noticed it ended when he died and he was on the cross. That in all effects, despite the last couple minutes where you see the rock come by and there's this brilliant light, but that was tossed in literally for the Protestant crowd. But they do focus very heavily on the suffering Christ as the atoning, and not the which was atoning. I don't want you to get that wrong. However, what makes Jesus so special is the risen Christ, where we go. But I don't believe there's a problem in respecting saints, caveat, for what they have done. St. Paul, St. Peter, St. James, St. John, they gave their lives for God. They lived completely, and I do respect that. Am I going to pray through them to Christ? It's not going to happen. They can't save my soul any more than my dear wife can. That's Jesus. That's God. That's the Holy Spirit. And as such, that's where we start getting in trouble when we bring other stuff in. And if you notice I was probably in the 80s and 90s, there was a really big push among entertainers to find God, but what they would do is they'd find like Kabbalah in the Jewish religion. And when Madonna says, "I believe in Kabbalah," everybody went, "Yay!" And Kabbalah is one tiny little part of the whole reverence of the Jewish faith. In fact, it's a kind of off the road. Yes, and that's a great one, because that brings us back apart, because like Pam was doing to me, why would in the world would we worship a cow? I'm sorry, cows are dumb. They taste great, but they're not the brightest things in the world. But again, all these other false religions and false gods, fertility, why is fertility stuck in, you know, the growing of the crops, the rain gods, the sun gods, the I need squirrels to plant acorns so we can have oak trees, so we're gonna do the squirrels. And that's an absolutely, we forget, or we have not been brought up to understand that God is the creator and God is the only one that is worthy of being worshipped. And again, that goes back to exactly what the Ten Commandments, especially these first commandments, mean to us. Why they are there. And God started out, again, very directly, "I am the Lord your God." It's the definitive statement. I am the Alpha, I am the Omega. It is, I am the one who took care of you. I am the one that loves you. And I am the one that will continue to love and take care of you. So, good questions. Now I have to figure out where I was. Brief attention should be called to the characterization of the Lord as a jealous God. If it is God's nature to be one, alone, and unique, then it must be also his nature to be jealous, and which in this case means neither more nor less than to maintain this nature consistently. He is going to be God at all times. He is going to be the only God that you are subject to. And he is a jealous God. It, on the one hand, means you worship me, you belong to me, but to others who either consider themselves God or, I don't want to go back too much into historical theology, I'm going to have to, because also along this time is as, and it will happen to the nations of Israel, as you go from place to place, he who had the strongest guy won the war for the land. And if you lost, well, my God was stronger than your God. And this God is saying, you belong to me, you are mine. I own you, I will protect you, I will love you. I am not going to share you with those idols that we just put the prohibition on. I am not going to share you with another God, which is why he does the golden calf, while we're up getting the Ten Commandments, was a wonderful example of that. And gone for a little while, says, oh, by the way, let's just melt all our gold down, and just like we did in Egypt, we'll go back to our old ways. And this is a very, very stern warning saying, you belong to me. I'm not going to allow you to be taken away. And that's the other side of it. It is a declaration that if you are faithful to me and I've accepted for you, I will fight for you tooth and nail. The verses in the New Testament where you cannot be forcibly taken from God's hands, from Jesus' hands. It's just not possible. There's no power in the world that can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, and but it also shows the difference between God and us. The jealousy of God is for our good. It's not because I want to do something better. It's kind of a side note, is I'm going to take you the way you are, and I understand who you are and why you are that way. Going beyond that. In later Judaism, the interpretation of verse 5 held that the sins of the father were visited upon the children when they retain the evil deeds of their father. And even when this is not the case, we must agree that children can and do suffer generation upon generation for the sins, the stupidities, the short-sightedness, and the selfishness of their fathers. There is generational angst there. Now, and I think all, and I'm going to go personal here. I cannot say whether my kids are going to pay for my sins. I don't get the feeling with that under the Lord. But then again, God is dealing with the Jewish people right here. However, there are generations, entire generations, that were not faithful to God, and namely the generation we're talking about here, who did all the whining and crying because God wasn't taking care of them and disobeyed him and did not make it into the promised land. However, the children did so, but there's an entire generation there that is missing. And generation after generation of priests and people not obeying God led to Babylon. And so it has gone on. There's a part of me that wants to say, God's not going to do that to you. And the Bible shows where it has happened, and I'm just... It's one of those things, how can a loving God do that? But you know what? Sometimes we're responsible for what we do. But he does follow that up immediately in verse 6. But show loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. And here's again, there's that agreement. You keep my commandments, I will be a loving God. I will take care of you. I could also go back and say that, yes, the people of Israel that died before they could get to the promised land were not forsaken by God. They just were not allowed to see. Their punishment for not obeying God was they just did not get to see the promised land where their children did. And the people that were in captivity for all those years in Babylon eventually got to go back. God continued his love for them, but they were punished like any good father, any good leader would do. I mean, if you don't love your kids enough to discipline them, you run into a problem. And God disciplines us right and left. And he's basically saying, that's what I'm going to do to you. Okay. Just as we admit this fact, we should also realize that men in all times have been far more ready to acknowledge God as a redeemer rather than a judge, even though it should be obvious that if God is God, he's got to do both, which is what I just said. God redeems each and every one of us. He loves us. He will care for us. He will chastise us, and he will punish us when we need to be punished. Um, And I'm going to go questions, comments here because it's starting to get late and I'm not sure I have enough time to do name. So, questions, comments, massive confusion. Let me answer that. When were the 12 tribes of Israel constituted? And when was the tribe of Levi, which were the priests, established? So way back in the beginning when I was talking about this is the beginning of bringing order out of chaos, the Lord is also setting up. Each tribe would have their own responsibilities, and he was setting up Aaron and his sons to become the tribes, the priests in the tribe of Levi, which were responsible for the Ark of the Covenant, for the spiritual, for holding worship services. So this is the beginning, and in answer to that, it could have been very loose, and I do not actually have a concrete answer to what you said, but this is working towards it. Well, but then again, the oral tradition passed down from Abraham on, these are what is required of you, the Lord is your God, and that was passed from father and son to mother and daughter. So you had that type of a setup, and you had that type of teaching and learning on who the Lord was. So yes, it was there, it was rudimentary, but it's about to take true effect, and is the nation of Israel is going to start coming out of the tribes that are coming here now. We'll go over the Ten Commandments, trust me all. But the background is this is we've had the Ten Commandments around since we were knee high to a grasshopper, and the background of them still confuses us at times. And there are still people out there that will disagree with what I've said this evening. And that's okay. The only one that will know it and will give us the right one is God. Because that's a wonderful analogy. When I read a book, I have in my hand what that character looks like. And when I hold it, that's who it is. And when I see the movie, sometimes it's either yeah, or oh boy, did they miss the mark on that one. It kind of ruins it. However, the one thing that really does set the Lord apart is he does not have the need, on one hand, to show you, to have a physical representation, because God literally is everywhere. He is the world. He's the sun. He's the stars. He's the creatures that he's created. Now, the other hand, too, and I think the wonderful thing about it, is God, the picture of God you have is yours, and he fits you. To some people, you know, God is George Burns out of the movie. Or God could be a little old lady down the street who is. It's what you happen to see, how you see God. Is that the true representation? No, but it makes you comfortable. And I, personal view, don't think there's anything wrong with that. And God can be whomever is comfortable in your mind to picture him. Because my mind can't comprehend who he is. But again, we're people. We need to be able to make a picture of something that will satisfy ourselves. It's like all, if you go to Revelations, they have all these, the beautiful colors and everything else. But is that truly, can that truly explain the grandeur of what the New Jerusalem is going to be like? Or are they using pictures and descriptions of things that we can comprehend and that we can get an idea of what they look like. And I think how we physically see God or picture God is exactly the same way. And to be perfectly honest, I've never actually sat down and tried to picture God in my mind for any other reason. It's because I think you see him in everything, in a lot. You see him in people's actions. And I prefer to look at the people around us, the good things, the things that make us happy, the things that actually comfort us. It's more on the physical, the touchable, than it is on the spiritual. But yes, I like that. which is exactly, I think, what the prohibition against forming other idols or other likenesses. And I think that's what is, I think that nails it exactly on what that means. Thank you. Thank you, because I was going to figure out that, and that's exactly, I believe, what you're feeling is it is the Holy Spirit, and entirely proper, as it should be. So, okay, before we go back to singing another song, questions, comments? We'll pick this up in 2 weeks.